Okay, now the image is live.
So I just want to talk briefly about the history of the dormitory section at Fall Creek, just to get it on the record.
Yeah.
So in a From the Desk of Elmer Hill memo dated April 21st, 1958, the General Secretary details the expenses that were accrued in building the East Side and Fall Creek Parkway YMCAs. Now, Elmer O. Hill was the General Secretary of the Greater Indianapolis YMCA during the late 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and served under IYMCA President Ortho Scales. And Scales was also the Vice President of Enos Coal Mining Company. So just for history about them. So in his From the Desk of Elmer O. Hill memo series, Hill reported on Fall Creek's various programs and forums, as well as the branch's facility renovations and features, such as air-conditioned office rooms and recreational rooms. So, and he reports that Sinan Avenue, which officially changed its name to Fall Creek in April 1958, would secure $50,000 to furnish the new Fall Creek facility, and that its residence section would be financed by a $400,000 loan. So the dormitory section made Fall Creek unique, as we've talked about, because it was the only YMCA which provided low-cost lodgings for individuals.
Anywhere in the state of Indiana,
Anywhere in the state of Indiana. So we've talked about the difficulties and kind of the impossibilities of actually renovating and modifying the building. So let's talk about how the public media described residents of Fall Creek dormitories who were there.
And this during my watch.
Right, during your watch. And this was during the time that they knew that Mesho decided to close the dorm, or that Mesho closed the dorm on March 29th, 2002. So this was during that time.
Well, just real quickly, in terms of the history, why did we build a dorm again at Fall Creek? Well, the reason was because there were limited choices for people of color, for black people, to find a place, especially those who were coming into the community and trying to find new opportunities and employment. The Fall Creek Y was one of the few choices that they had, that they were comfortable with. So there was a historical context, even in 1958, of course, when it was still under construction, for to have a residence there, as it did at Senate Avenue. The downtown Y was the only other residence until it closed in the early 70s. And so, and the reason that the Y even got into the residential business to begin with is because you didn't have Motel 8 and Radisson and all these other more economical places to choose to stay temporarily until you found a place to live. And so, again, during that dark period, you had the downtown Y residence, which was predominantly for whites. In fact, whites only. And gosh, if we didn't want them downtown, we better build a place for them to be so they're not knocking on the door of the downtown Y. That was reality. That was the history. It's not a history we're proud of, but that is a fact. And we have to acknowledge that. So they built a dorm for the Fall Creek Y because of that. And at that time, when I come in 1994, I had a lot of experience managing Ys that had residential wings, all of them going through various phases of change and challenges. And what Emory Hill was talking about was that there were renovations that were made, but limited in terms of how those dollars could be spent. I mean, you mentioned air-conditioned program spaces and offices. Right. The residence itself was not air-conditioned. And, you know, I don't know about you, but being in a cubicle when it's 100 degrees outside makes it very, very uncomfortable and almost inhuman. In fact, the rooms facing the west were really difficult because of the setting sun, the afternoon sun. It was horrible. So it was not an ideal situation. And when you have a summer, in fact, we would count how many 100 degree days in the summer and compare it to in terms of occupancy. Our occupancy during summer just plummeted. It was because the rooms weren't comfortable to be in. And you know, I said about, okay, well, let's air condition the rooms. And find out how much that would cost. and because of the nature of the construction and so forth, that was going to be very difficult to do, and then maintain the economics of operating the building. To have individual air conditioning units on every window in that residence would have exponentially increased the cost of operating the building and put the cost of staying in the dorm out of reach for the people we wanted to serve. So we had our hands tied behind us in terms of the original decisions that were made. And what you're seeing in the historical record, from the day the building opened, it was a financial problem. And part of it is because of its location. And what was happening, if you look at the historical record of sky views of the development of IUPUI, as that expanded, it took out rooftops of families and children, dislocated them. And then the construction of Interstate 65, and the Fall Creek Parkway was there from the beginning, but that's also a beautiful barrier that separated the Y from opportunities of access and convenience for families who lived on the other side. So it was doomed to fail to begin with. It was not a good decision to invest capital at that particular location. And we did the best that we could, those of us who inherited that situation. I trust that Elmer Hill, who was my predecessor, did the best he could. Will Peck was my predecessor for 19 years. He came from New York City, a man of immense integrity when it comes to issues of race. You don't survive in the history for long in New York City if you're known to be insensitive to the needs of any ethnic group, minority, in addition to African Americans. So he had a strong commitment, and the board reflected a strong commitment. It was just the frustration of realizing that we kind of locked ourselves into a position that wasn't going to succeed from the very beginning. So my enthusiasm, unbridled enthusiasm, when I arrived in 94, I can make this thing work, I became discouraged in the 7 years leading up to the decision that we had to close. So it was my influence with the board. If closure is inevitable, then the first thing we want to do is to make sure that the residents are taken care of. And the best way to do that is to close the residents first so that we could focus all of our energies on the needs of those 78 men. And we did it right. If we were going to close, we did it right. We made sure all 78 had a place to go. And it came down to 12 who were still in the residence within a month of closing. And I asked the staff, I said, help me understand what their needs are. And I empowered the staff. I said, okay, we're going to take care of these 12 men. If the problem is because they had a felony record and they couldn't even get into existing vacant housing because of their felony record, then I'll personally write a letter of recommendation based on each individual's track record of what they've been doing since leaving prison. And we found them all working, showing up for work on time, retaining their employment, and fulfilling all their obligations. Most important to landowners, they're going to pay their rent. They paid their rent on time with the Y. And then it came down to the issue is that they just didn't have the first and last month's rent as a down payment to move in. I said, we'll cover that. And we did. It cost us all of $2,800 to cover first and last month's rent for those 12 guys. And we were successful in helping those 12 guys. Then once we took care of that, then we, in the meantime, we had developed a special committee of the board to look at how do we want to address our perception of credibility in the community, and therefore how do we want to address that honestly and with the facts. And so we retained Ice Miller as legal counsel to make sure that we were dotting the I's and crossing the T's on all legal obligations. And then we retained Cease Garrick as public affairs consultant to the board to address the issues of credibility. And that's, we began to formulate a strategy, and we wanted to pay attention to the media that had special interest in the African American community. I appeared twice on Amos Brown. You know, it was, Amos Brown really gave me a hard time before we went on camera. I mean, he was blistering.
We're going to talk about his editorials. Yeah. That
yes.
About you.
And but when we were on air, I was stimulated. I mean, Amos Brown is one of the, in my opinion, arguably is one of the best media broadcasters in this community. His voice and his presence and his knowledge of what's happening in the community. He does his homework. He does his homework before he goes on camera and on the mic. And that won my respect immediately. And so I was prepared in advance, practiced in front of a camera, you know, and was asked the worst questions that could be asked. And in every response was developed to be sure that my emotions and everything was never caught by surprise, and to take, get out of my head with all the facts I had as a CEO and just kind of suspend that for a moment and listen to the emotions. So that was happening while we were closing the residence. And, you know, there wasn't really, except for articles in the media, there wasn't an outcry, by the way, from the community about closing the residence. There wasn't really that much investment, quite frankly, in the residence. And we did not take that as, by the way, a precursor to, well, doesn't look like it's going to be a cakewalk when we close the Y itself. We knew that that wasn't going to be the case, because there was a greater investment in terms of the history, in terms of the presence of program and staff and the membership of the Y itself. So that was the reason why we closed the residence when we did. And we gave them, actually the residents were given more advanced notice than the letter that they received. The letter was just formalizing what we had already had done, sitting down with them in advance to let them know this decision was coming down. So that in effect they had 90 days notice, but the letter came 60 days. Right. The letter was no surprise to the residents as it was reported in the media, except to maybe a few residents who had just moved in. Weren't aware because they weren't a part of the initial discussions we had with the other residents.
And that letter was dated January 31st,
yes,
2002. And as right. I aforementioned, Metro closed the dorm, or didn't close the dorm until March 2002.
Right, 60 days later. Right.
And so the last resident moved on March 29th.
Yes.
I wanted to know, could she talk about how LeBester Hobbs, could she talk about his role in this transition process? And now Hobbs, he had managed the residence hall since 1991.
That's correct. And I promoted him to executive years before that. And I have a high level of respect. When I moved in 1994 to take this position, LeBester was the only black at a staff retreat. And he came up to me at the end, and one-on-one, we had a little private conversation. And I'll never forget LeBester confronting me in a very nurturing and collegial style. It said, Norris, and he called me by my first name, and I was pleased that he was comfortable to call me by my first name. How long will it take until I'm not the only black in the room? And my response was, LeBester, I don't know what it means, but give me some time, there will be a difference. And when I left, there were 35 African Americans working full-time on the staff. And LeBester was our key person as far as the change that would take place. And I'm very proud of what he did. And I knew that my role was to take the heat, as much of the heat as I could, and take the blame, and to make sure that any communications that went out, in fact, I would sit around the table with all the branch execs and say, there's no one in this room that's going to be facing a lot of change and a lot of tough decisions, the man sitting right there. And I need all of you to give him your support, your understanding, and your sensitivity. but the decision was clearly made by myself and the board of directors of the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis. We wanted to take that full responsibility and not put the board of the Fall Creek Y in any position where they had to defend that decision. And we took all the heat for it. We knew going in that we had to own that responsibility. And so I didn't want Levester to be facing cameras or being put in a position where he had to defend it, because his role was far more important, to make sure 78 men got a place, a better place to be, that they could afford. And then when it came to closing the rest of the Y, again, we took the full responsibility for that decision. And, you know, by that time, I'd been called to another opportunity overseas in Jerusalem, and I wanted to be sure Levester was taken care of, and he's working for us to this day.
Right.
We did a lot of work to one of the changes in our culture was to change the culture perception of the janitor to becoming the director of property management, a professional position. Because we had all these assets in the community, who's taking care of them? And I didn't want the executive or any of the other professional staff to be burdened with the day-to-day decisions about the care and upkeep of facilities. And Levester really, as the director of the resident, was also taking care of the entire facility. And I grew to respect his acumen for making good decisions with little direction from the corporate office. And so I opened up an opportunity for him to be the director of property management for the Jordan Y.
So when you talk about taking the heat, how Metro took the heat for the closing of the dormitories, how did the public media present Metro's decision? You know, how did it present? Since there's articles about how, you know, these men were homeless and how the Y was just kind of casting
putting them out on the street. Well, that was the perceived notion that we were basically going to be the absentee landlord and forcing these folks out on the street, and that was an entirely different perception that was popularized by reaction of those who wrote stories but didn't bother to interview us in advance for the story to find out what the facts were and what we were doing. But we sort of anticipated that was going to happen because we looked at how the media treated YMCs around the country who were doing had done the same thing in the previous 5-10 years, and noted that the media's first reaction was demonizing the Y. In fact, there was a political cartoon in a North Carolina newspaper when the Y closed the residence of Jesus walking out of the Y with the bags in hand with no place to go. Picture of Jesus Christ walking away from the Y. Which, as I interviewed in advance leadership in those situations, they said, well, let us tell you what we did do. And I began to realize there's the truth and the fact, and then there's, you know, journalism who reacted to the same stories they covered in other SRO housing or dilapidated housing where the landlord just simply evicted the residents without notice and just assumed we were just like those landlords. So it took us a while to meet individually with people who wrote those stories and say, if you're interested in the facts and what our commitment is to these 78 men, we're prepared to interview. And so other reporters showed up and began to listen to our story, and we had everything in writing available to them. And our commitment was to total disclosure. And so the media that did show up, and we paid full-page ads in the Recorder to outline all of our facts and just lay it out to the community. But I wanted to focus our energy on those 78 men and let our actions speak for themselves. And I knew that it would take time for people who wanted to know the truth to find the truth. In fact, at that time, there was a czar for homelessness appointed by the president in Washington. He had an Italian name from Massachusetts. And he sent a guy to interview me how we handled this transition, because he thought it was a model. Because their SRO housing were being closed around the country. And so if you're going to do it, how do you do it right? And we were an example, a model for how to do it right. And I was pleased with that. I wasn't pleased with the decision that we had to make. I wasn't pleased with that at all. That wasn't my vision in coming to the city and making things better. But we had to face the music, the financial reality of what was happening, and realization that if we're going to truly meet the needs of the inner city, then we need to redirect our resources. So
according to the statement that the Metropolitan Association delivered to dormitory residents, and like I said, it was dated January 31st, 2002.
Right.
The YMCA Executive Committee decided to close the dormitory section because it was, and I quote, inadequate to meet the needs of the community and would not be cost effective to remodel or renovate it.
Correct.
Which you've touched on.
Right.
The statement also said that the board would rechannel resources that would have been used to renovate the dorm to programming, which you just touched on. So.
And we did. I mean, we redirected some resources to give it one last chance.
Okay.
You know, to see if we could resurrect enrollment and so forth. That we invested in positions at the Black Expo. That's when I discovered that most of the African Americans attending Black Expo were from outside the city. So that was a waste of time and resources for us. But the Black Expo leadership provided us a lot of promotion and announcements, and it was really excellent cooperation, and we appreciated it. But despite all those efforts, we just weren't getting the response for membership enrollment and participation, and that's with infusion of a lot of resource. And that's it. What it affirmed for us, when I say us, the corporate office, and for some of the leadership at Fall Creek who had served on the board there and staff, is that it's location, location, location. Mm-hmm. And we were getting better results just by moving into other neighborhoods and establishing a presence there because we were more convenient when we did that. And the additional infusion into programming just didn't yield the results that we were getting elsewhere. So it affirmed our decision to close the facility later.
So the Y closed in September 2003. So let's discuss the statistical reports and public media controversy mm-hmm. surrounding the close of the Fall Creek YMCA.
Yes.
So towards the close of General Secretary Elmer Hill's term, Fall Creek's financial situation was stable. In a memo dated September 25, 1967, Hill reports that Fall Creek, quote, had a good August with a 97.9% income, close quote. But between the 1960s and 1990s, the racial landscape of the immediate area surrounding Fall Creek really changed. According to a 2000 population analysis of Fall Creek service area, which is in the records, in room 20, or in room M, I'm sorry, in the basement of the English Foundation building. So according to this population analysis, the total population of the Y's immediate area dropped from 78,519 in 1960 to 28,464 by 1990. Housing units dropped from 27,652 in 1960 to 12,705 in 1990, and the 65 and over population increased from 12% to 17%. And this 1960 to 1990 population analysis was completed by Roberta L. Brooker, who was the data center coordinator at the Indiana State Library, and she's currently state librarian at the time of this interview. So according to the records, these statistics reflected, quote, demographics within a 1 mile radius of the Fall Creek YMCA, close quote. Why did Metro decide to commission a population analysis of this in 2000?
Why did it commission a population analysis?
Right, why did you decide to, I guess, like get a population analysis or to have have Roberta Brooker?
Well, we knew that, and of course, in the year 2000, mm-hmm. the census was about to be
right.
done again, but mm-hmm. we wouldn't actually see
right.
the results of that census until 2004, and that We couldn't wait for that. Mm-hmm. So we were looking for what would be an objective source outside the YMCA to update the 94 analysis of the 90 census, because we knew that there were a lot of changes taking place since the 94 analysis. And but we needed verification. We needed an objective third party to set the record in terms of were our assumptions correct, that we could align. Why is it that we were having a decline in membership and program participation? We wanted an objective assessment as to what was happening in the community. And it turned out our assumptions were correct, but we needed the credibility. I mean, the YMCA doesn't have credibility to talk about statistics of what's happening in the community. It needed to come from a source that looks at this as a full time, with a degree of perceived objectivity. And so that was the most current resource that we can go to at that time. We also were aware that POLIS was established at IUPUI. It was another asset that became even more important later on. But at the time, this was the most credible source for us to tap to say, are we making the right assumptions here before we move forward? And that was the reason.
So how was this population data, or this kind of population analysis data, manifested in the financial status of the Fall Creek YMCA? How did, the financial status of Fall Creek reflect the data?
Well, it reflected it accurately. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically Fall Creek was, it was a good YMCA. Mm-hmm. It wasn't doing something wrong or we all have sources of incompetency when we establish centers where we're employing staff, but we work to hold staff accountable and their reward for performance, part of which is keeping their job. But we had a good crew there at Fall Creek. They just were faced with a lot of obstacles that were not under their control. And successful YMCAs are successful because they are convenient to a minimum population of 30,000 people. That's a benchmark from experience of over 2,800 YMCAs around the country, in which we collect statistics and we consult with our national office. What are the benchmarks at a minimum that we can anticipate successful membership and program participation? It's established by perceived convenience of a surrounding population of a minimum of 30,000 people. And in the history in which you just reported, we went from 26,000 to 12,000 households. Now within that, you immediately say, okay, well, let's multiply that by 2.5 to get us a rough estimate of what that household is in terms of population. Theoretically, even with 12,000 households, we're close to that minimum population threshold. But you have to look at other things that are happening within a 1 mile, 2 mile, 3 mile radius. And we have an interstate infrastructure dividing the community, a major green park space, not to mention the expansion of IUPUI.
Right, which intensified in the 1960s. Really.
And then you had the Central Business District and so forth. And you think these are just glowing opportunities. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the historical context as to why Senate Avenue and why Fall Creek, they were designed to serve residential communities. Exception being the dormitory. But that was no more peculiar exception than YMCAs with dormitories around the country at the time. But you know, the YMCA was getting out of the dormitory business. There are very few. The largest YMCA hotels in the world are still in New York City with 13,000 rooms. We had 97. We took a group of board members to the Columbus, Ohio YMCA, who was renovating a 400-room downtown hotel. We wanted to learn from them what are the possibilities of having a viable residence before we made that decision. And we began to realize it comes down to keys. In the hotel hospitality trade, is you have a minimum number of keys, in other words, number of rooms, in order to make it. And we were below that threshold, big time. And so that's when we began to realize that our chances of making it in the residential service area was down. And then freeing us up to do focus on membership and program only at Fall Creek, we wanted that opportunity, and we invested a lot of resources. And we were having, and so looking at those demographics again, we said, okay, where are they moving to? It wasn't about just resting on, say, well, we give up, they're moving out. We want to know, where are they moving to? And that's when we began to realize that there were pockets of opportunities outside of that 1 mile radius of the Fall Creek Y, and we went to work on that immediately.
So you've already talked about the causes of kind of this demographic decline surrounding Fall Creek, and one of those causes, which we've already thoroughly talked about, was
the residential demographic decline.
Residential
rooftops with families and children.
Okay. Right.
Actually, the demographics were being enriched, but not in the manner in which some people were willing to acknowledge or accept at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So the residential demographic decline around Fall Creek, and one of the causes of that, which you've talked about, was the inter-district busing order. And just for the record, I just wanted to say that this integration-oriented process was mandated by U.S. District Court Judge S. Hugh Dillon in 1971 as one of the constraints of his decision in the case U.S. v. the Board of School Commissioners, Indianapolis, Indiana. So that was part of that order, and this was taking place in the 70s, this one-way busing, which is basically busing kids from the residences in the inner city to outlying townships, outlying suburban townships. So could you talk more about the statistical reports that were done or kind of, I guess, commissioned by the Greater Indianapolis YMCA, which concerned Fall Creek? I know that there was a good 8 years of before the close, during which Metro was, commissioning reports about the area surrounding Fall Creek.
Well, for the record, I want to indicate that it was not just about Fall Creek.
Okay.
We were commissioning population studies for all of our branches.
All of the branches.
Yes. I mean, we were doing mapping studies of existing membership and where those members were coming from. So we were mapping membership to look at the trends in terms of where do members live in conjunction with the Y they belong to. And this gave us one of our first insights about Fall Creek, is we noticed that the majority of members at Fall Creek were coming from Pike Township, where we had no YMCA presence ever historically. And no one could ever give me a good reason why. I just never had a Y in the northwest quadrant of Marin County. And we were commissioning population studies for all of our branches. In regards to Fall Creek, we were doing the same population studies, but also adding interest to make sure we understood what was happening in the community from secondary data, with a peculiar focus on the dynamics and history of what was happening in that neighborhood, to gain us additional insight. But we began with population studies that were being done at all branches, not just Fall Creek. And the reason was because we wanted to find out how relevant we were in terms of locations of existing facilities, and were there trends that would indicate to us we need to be thinking about additional sites to be more convenient to other population centers? Mm-hmm. And then if we did, what would that do to cannibalize membership at existing facilities? Fall Creek membership was being cannibalized by people moving out to other neighborhoods, not because of a decision the Y made. It was a decision made by policy in education, particularly in public schools, but also in higher education. And what was happening in terms of the vision for the city moving forward to become the amateur sports capital of the world. And the facilities, the Natatorium and the NIFS, were created because the Olympic Committee decided not to locate the mega training center here in Indianapolis. It went to Colorado Springs, and the people at the time said, okay, we'll show you. So they built NIFS and they built an auditorium, which have really become assets for IUPUI to be a Division I school. So I'm not saying it was a bad decision, but it also displaced more properties there and created interesting dynamics of competition for the Fall Creek Y. NIFS was intended to be a sports training facility, and after opening for 6 months, they declared we got to become more like a YMCA. I'm quoting the executive at that time, and they began selling memberships. If I were in his shoes, I'd be doing the same thing in order to support the overhead of such a magnificent facility. So, I mean, a lot of decisions were being made that had a direct impact on the probability of success for the Fall Creek Y.
So on June 25th, 2003, the Metropolitan Association Board voted to close the Fall Creek YMCA on September 30th of that year in 2003. The branch had about 660 members at the time. And of course, Metro's decision to close Fall Creek was not without controversy.
Yes.
A lot of controversy in the form of membership drives, in the form of the formation of activist groups, even gatherings outside of the
Yes.
English Foundation building. So let's discuss this organized public reaction to Metro's decision to close the branch on the financial grounds that you've just discussed. And we'll also talk about other understandings of Fall Creek's, of why Fall Creek's membership declined. So I want to know, how would you summarize the arguments that were centered on keeping Fall Creek open? How would you summarize arguments that were, you know, in support of keeping Fall Creek open, those arguments?
We were not surprised by that reaction. But let's talk about those 630 members first, because
right.
that was our focus, to meet with them.
Right.
And help them to find other places for them to continue their commitment to personal wellness.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an example. There was a group of about 15, 20 elderly women, African American women,
mm-hmm.
Who were committed to weight reduction, but
mm-hmm.
they needed the pool. The pool is a great tool to help people who are overweight, because it lifts, it gives less stress on their joints and so forth, so that they could exercise without pain. And these women said, well, there's no other place for us to go. And we looked at their addresses and found that the Ransburg Y would be a lot more convenient for them than the Fall Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with the staff to have the ladies invited to Ransburg. Now, you mentioned Elmer Hill's quote, that there was a Y built on the east side at the same time Fall Creek. They were built in the same year. That was the Ransburg Y.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? The architectural rendering in terms of the allocation of space and so forth were quite similar. It's just that Ransburg was without a residence. But when you go inside, the footprint is very similar to that of the Fall Creek Y. So when the ladies came and saw the pool and so forth, they said, gosh, this feels like the Fall Creek Y. And we offered an opportunity for one of the aquatic staff at Fall Creek to go to work at Ransburg, so that the ladies felt like they had someone that they were familiar with. And actually, they were quite thrilled to be able to go to a place that was more convenient for them. They just didn't know that they were welcome. Again, they were in their 60s and 70s and grew up in a history when they weren't welcome, even in the community in which they found themselves living in. So. We worked with those 600 and some odd, and many of them transferred to Y's that were more convenient to them and involved more of their families. The reason they chose Fall Creek was because it's more convenient to where they worked, not where they lived. So, the group of members, two-thirds of them that we could not serve very well, were commuting from Pike Township, and we had no presence there. And that's when we worked with the board to say, look, in order for us to continue serving the community better, in addition to African Americans, is that we've got to establish ourselves in Pike Township. And so we began recruiting board members that had a stake in the future of Pike Township, either had a business there or lived there. And we started with people that we knew that had businesses up there to come on board, like Steve Corbett. Bill Mays had an influence. Others who hadn't established in that corridor, a corridor going to the Northwest. And we began building a presence there. If we couldn't build a building, that we were going to find a place to lease. And so we started with a leasehold agreement on the outside edge of what's called Park 100. It's a huge industrial area up there. And they offered us places on the inside of the industrial complex. I said, our experience nationwide is putting the Y at that location competing with 18-wheelers is not a good idea. So they found us an excellent location on the outside edge facing Pike Township Schools campus. It was ideal for temporary. And it had green space around it and so forth on a corner with not the most ideal parking, but a great place for us to start. In the meantime, we were looking for a permanent home. And I think we found the property now after I'm left. And so we couldn't serve that original 630 members. Now let's go back to your question about controversy. I began to realize that those who were the loudest voices in leading the controversy were not in fact members of the Y. And so I began to realize that they had a stake though in the outcome of our decision, and that is how this was being portrayed and putting them in a position of having to answer to those who felt like this was a decision of abandoning the community. Okay? And it's just another vestige of the pain and struggle that had been going on for years before the Y made this decision. The Y was the last remaining, among the few institutions that remained alive for a long period of time. I mean, we were taking heat in our bottom line and financial losses that were almost $500,000 a year and still stood ground there and until it just became obvious that there was never going to be a recovery to the bottom line. It was going to continue to be a loss. Now, I make the distinction between a loss and a subsidy. Subsidy is actually going towards programs or getting results. We don't consider that a loss. A loss is an empty whirlpool in the men's health club. That's a loss. That is, I mean, there's no quarter in the community which I could take that to. Would you like to underwrite an empty whirlpool in the men's health club? And so, and that was just a figurative speech because there were a lot of attributes of that building that were no longer assets to the community we were trying to serve, and it was just an overhead loss. And we prepared our facts, and my experience in dealing with issues of this controversy is the facts are immediately pushed aside, ignored. And we were prepared for that and listened to the emotions. And of course, I was personally demonized, and I was told, you will be demonized. Be prepared for that. Put on your armor and listen to it. And it wasn't fun. It wasn't fun at all. I went before what was called Murder Row. It's a group of black men who gather on the near east side at a church. And I knew it was going to be not a happy experience on a Saturday morning. And about half the group was ready to engage me, and the other half said, we don't want to do this. And what I witnessed in that meeting was not so much, yes, I took a lot of heat, but what pained me even more was the vicious attacks of black men on black men. I should not have been in that meeting when that was happening. It's like dirty laundry being shared to a guest from the outside. And that pained me more than any slander directed towards me personally. That the why was the pivotal point that was bringing not only division between blacks and whites, but blacks among themselves. That pained me more than anything. And that reaffirmed for me that if we could work through this controversy and eventually listen as we did to the emotions, in the meantime, meeting with other black leaders of the community and laying out the facts and discussing it openly and full disclosure. We were having other meetings in the community, met with anybody who wanted to meet with us. And for those who were feeling like we were somehow manipulating the facts and so forth and so on, that was part of that controversy, is that we laid all of our books open to anybody who wanted to investigate the facts and figures. But we put it, we took everything to Ice Miller, to the legal, where they could go outside the YMCA and under legal counsel and under oath know that we had disclosed everything, general ledgers, balance sheets, everything.
And was this in response to demands from groups like, it was like groups like Members United to Save the Fall Creek YMCA?
Yes.
I know they demanded
yes.
full disclosure of
yes.
the books, so this
yes.
was the response to that.
Right, and we felt like we needed to create a location away from the corporate office of the Y, in a place where that the books are there, you can come and look at them. And we had people there to answer questions about detail, and if they could answer, then they'd call me and we would help fill in. But we were committed to total disclosure.
Right.
And not only that, making and facilitating that in the most objective way possible, to give them another location where they could go and do it without me being there or other Y officials being there, but just having total access to our records.
So one of the ways that the Metro laid out the facts was through two public releases titled An Open Letter to the Community,
yes.
was the first one, and also The Truth About the Fall Creek YMCA, which was the second public release. And Metro actually paid to have these published in the Indianapolis Recorder on September 26, 2003.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about the public release titled The Truth About the Fall Creek YMCA. I know it was compiled by these YMCA Strategic Communications Committee, which I think you mentioned before is like the committee that dealt with public relations.
Well, I mean, at this point in time, Bill Mays, Joe Slash, Johnson at Ice Miller, Lacey Johnson, Mike, let me go to my notes here, Michael Rodman. These guys had stepped up to the plate and realized that in the best interest of the community, this issue had to be resolved. And so the board empowered them to make decisions about what they needed in order to work through this process. And we basically assigned Ice Miller to them and Cease Garrick to them. And gave them and really empowered that group to make decisions of what was needed in order to work through this pain of the window pane, pain, P-A-I-N and P-A-N-E, of controversy that we were anticipating. That's why we went through the population statistic. We also retained, what do we do with the assets once we close? I mean, we thought about that before, we closed. What's the future direction for this? And at the time, Center Township was not at the table. We had a real estate appraiser go in and do an objective analysis as to the value of the property, because we wanted to be responsible stewards of that property, and we wanted to know the value. And once we received that report, then it was a decision about how do we place these assets to continue serving the needs of the community. Mm-hmm. So we set some criteria as to what would be the criteria for selecting a buyer, not just any buyer, mm-hmm. but someone who would be committed to continue serving the community. That was our vision. So the controversy was emotional. And we began to realize that this was an opportunity for politicians to show up and take it on as an issue. And by the way, all of them, I recognized as names that were whose grandparents or fathers were leaders of the Synod Avenue Y. So it was in effect, in some ways, more of the legacy of Synod Avenue than the legacy of Fall Creek. And what's going to happen to that legacy once the Fall Creek Y closes? And so part of that was our response to commitment to developing the history of the Synod Avenue Y, which we followed through, retained Stanley Warren to do an accurate, objective history of the Synod Avenue Y, and it was published. We're now committed to do that for Fall Creek when it's the right time to write that historical perspective. And again, retain an objective author to write that history. We want the truth to be said, and I think part of that is the controversy. And because there's a lot of learnings for the community for this in terms of how do you respond to the crisis of the media crisis of this controversy and weigh in the facts at an appropriate time, but listen first to the emotions of people's feelings. And did we handle it well? I mean, that's for history to tell. I have to confess that I knew that if this were to happen under my watch, regardless how well I handled it, that maybe my days were numbered to be the CEO, because there would be too much pain and controversy attached to my watch for me to continue as an effective CEO. So I knew going through this that this decision would probably mean that I needed to look for another opportunity, even though I was close to retirement.
I want to talk about the Declaration of Independence letter that was faxed to you from Gene Ely, I guess it's Gene Ely, the chairperson of the Fall Creek YMCA Board of Managers.
Yes.
And it was actually, the letter was dated September 22nd,
yes,
2003.
Yes, I remember that.
Right. And one of the reasons that I thought was interesting that she included in the Declaration of Independence about why Fall Creek was closing. I just wanted to read that main reason and then get your thoughts on why.
Sure.
So quote, our belief that the focus by the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis on the Fall Creek YMCA as a fitness center has detracted from the overall mission and core values of the YMCA in that branch. This has resulted in a deletion of traditional YMCA programs and programs that focus on the cultural heritage of many of our members. And so, and this was sent to you by the chairperson of the Fall Creek YMCA Board of Managers in a Declaration of Independence letter, and basically a letter detailing that they wanted to break away from the Greater Indianapolis YMCA. So I wanted to ask you, as president and CEO, did you think that the YMCA's mission emphasized physical fitness or general service during your time there as president? Do you think that its mission was not aligned with the community needs?
Well, first of all, Ms. Ely is someone I admire and respect. I enjoyed my meeting with her. She was a committed member of the Fall Creek Y, and I felt her passion and her commitment, and it was real and authentic. And I do remember that. They were, I think, intrigued with the fact that there were still independent black YMCAs in the country. Butler Street, which by the way is now closing. And that's a very famous YMCA because that's where Martin Luther King and that's where the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, which was the leaders of the Civil Rights Movement, actually met there at the Butler Street Y. It's closing. There are, I believe, 11 other independent black YMCAs who continue to operate in the context of communities being served by the Metropolitan Y. And these are black YMCAs that are survivors of the current vestiges of the separate but equal YMCAs that were built back in the 30s of the last century and earlier. And in fact, when you read the minutes of the Synod Avenue Y, you almost had a perception that it was an independent Y. And in fact, a branch of the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis. And so They were barring from that history. In fact, that they said, well, they're independent black YMCAs, maybe we can become. What they didn't know is that every one of those Ys were faced with very serious financial issues. Owed the government back payments on FICA and unemployment benefits and so forth that were just simply ignored for years, and catching up with them. And so all of us were trying to figure out how to preserve these Ys, and it was more of a move towards integrating them to become a part of the large Y. In the meantime, the other Ys were integrating. So the notion of having an independent black YMCA was not necessarily the answer, because they're purposely limiting the focus of the market they're serving. They simply didn't have a chance to succeed, but we worked with them on that, helped them understand the cost of operating that building, showed them, separated out all the other costs. If you do nothing else, here's how much it costs just to open the doors. And I think quietly they began to realize that their notion, however enthusiastic they were about it, that they were going to be faced with a lot of obstacles. But we wouldn't have known that if it weren't for the fact that later Center Township took ownership of the facility and invested all their resources in it for 7 years to create a center focusing on minority health issues. And they faced the same music that we faced. It's not about being bad or good, or good manager, bad manager. Again, location, location, location.
We're just going to take another 5-minute break, and then after that, we're just going to talk about Amos Brown, your kind of communication with Amos Brown, mm-hmm. and then just very quickly about evaluating the organization. But it's just 3 more questions left.
Okay, basically. Great.